Patrick Dolan, employment lawyer. How you doing, my friend?
I'm great. It's great to see the sun.
What does an employment lawyer do?
Anything with regard to workplace issues. So compensation, discrimination, you know, non-competes. We get a lot of questions about non-competes, non-solicitation agreements. So hiring, firing, anything about your job.
And you work with Karen Conti, the biggest biceps in all the land.
Yep.
The biggest biceps on the bar, I'll say.
She's ripped.
And she does family law.
She does.
And if we're doing a legal roundtable, I guess if someone calls with a family law question, you can text your partner and find out the
answer.
Or she can call in. She's always welcome to. That's what we're doing today.
Or she can talk about it on Sunday her show.
On tomorrow.
Yep.
Mike Leonard, how are you doing, my friend?
Good. We have to start with what the studio is abuzz about, John.
Ooh.
The studio is abuzz, right?
About?
Right, Patrick?
I would say, yes.
I mean,
buzzing
just
today.
The vibe is crazy. John, just listeners, he's wearing this green, kind of a zip-up, kind of indoor-outdoor thing.
It's a bomber.
Very Ted Danson, Larry David, and probably younger audience, but he looks fantastic. Let's face it.
Just a white plain t-shirt.
You know, usually we see him in the Hawks hoodie, you know, on a tour from the stadium.
Going to a game,
exactly. Yeah, let's face it. In the studio, he doesn't usually look this good.
No, he looks good.
Let's just be honest with the listener.
I think it might be a fresh haircut, too. What do you think, Mike?
I think he might even coif the hair.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
No, I think he dressed up for us.
He almost seems embarrassed by the attention, but I think he loves it.
No, of course he loves it.
This is what happens when you put two lawyers in the room at the same time and turn both their mics on.
I don't think John has a problem with attention.
No.
That's just a guess. Just guessing.
Mike Leonard, you're a federal defense attorney. What's that all about?
Oh, trying to change the subject.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So we regularly try cases in federal court and try to defeat the federal prosecutors.
You fight the man.
We do, and it's a lot of fun.
You are a shark, as they say, right?
I guess. Yeah, I guess I'm a shark.
Actually, I feel this way about both. I do feel this way about both you guys. I feel like you revel in being in someone's corner, fighting against like a David Goliath sort of thing. You agree with that, Mike?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, it's the ultimate challenge, especially in federal court. In federal cases, you know, you feel like the deck is stacked every which way you can against the defendant. So it's a great feeling to represent an individual against all the power and resources that they can bring. I agree. I think it's a great feeling, and it definitely is the underdog feeling, which helps drive me.
And Patrick, oftentimes 100%. You're representing an employee. Sometimes the employer is a big mega company.
Usually, they usually are because, you know, Fortune 50, 100 companies, I mean, against their in-house or outside lawyers in issues involving employment discrimination, for example, where they don't think they did anything wrong. And so there's a ton of pushback. And I love my job, to be honest. I love it.
847 wants to know, and my former employer, I just left a couple weeks ago, usually gave a lump sum for a match for a 401k at the start of the new year. My employee handbook says that as long as I was employed on the last day of the year, I should get that lump sum. They're telling me I'm not going to get it because I left the company.
Well, you're entitled to it. And so it's a breach of contract claim and maybe a violation of ERISA, for example. But you know, you're absolutely entitled to it.
Especially if it's in the handbook. Like, as long as you're employed on the last day of the year.
Yeah, and that's commonly how it goes in terms of, you know, 401k matches. So I'm happy to talk to this person.
Yeah, for sure. What number can they reach you at?
312-332-7800.
Okay.
They have to wait till 3 p.m.
Yes, exactly.
You know, they can't be interrupted in the show.
Or Monday morning.
Yeah.
Does that phone number doesn't go to your cell, does it? You would never have time to relax.
No. But my, you know, cell's not hard to find. It's on my signature block or in my
website. 312-332-7800. Let's keep it there. Mike Leonard answers in the middle of the night if you call him.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I'll answer it anytime, day or night. No, it's funny because my work phone bounces to my cell.
Oh man.
So it rings like twice and then it bounces to the cell. So yeah, you get calls all the time. But you know, if it's non-working hours, I'm pretty good about trying to ignore that. But you know, but sometimes you have to take them at odd hours and early morning, late at night, because people need you.
For sure.
All right, let's take our first break and let's open the phone lines, the text lines, 312-981-7200. You guys are at least comfortable hearing any legal question, right?
Sure, let's go for it.
Any. And we'll debate the legal issues of day as well.
Mm. Yeah.
And if listeners want to ask more questions about John's outfit and haircut, have at it.
312-981-7200. I'll give you all that after this on WGN. 312-981-7200. Iridian answering the phones right now to see if we get some general legal questions.
She looks busy over there. She's like talking to people.
Very in-depth. She's trying.
Yeah.
She's just trying to answer the question herself
now. Serious. She probably can.
Iridian could probably figure
she's
it out
heard
at this
point. So much.
She knows all the answers.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. One story that's in the news, Mike Leonard and Patrick, is that the House, the government, essentially seems poised to ban TikTok. A lot of states had banned their workers from using it on their state phones, which I think makes sense. Even the federal government, I believe, has banned it from federal phones being done, but still personal allowed to do it. The committee in the House tackling this voted 50-0, which, by the way, I can't believe there's a committee that represents 1/8 the size of the entire House, but 50-0 across bipartisan basis to ban TikTok. It'll go to the full House where it's expected to pass. Seems to be likely to pass the Senate, although we haven't seen the tea leaves so much. But President Biden said yesterday that he would sign that bill if it got to them. And I can imagine a lot of people upset by that. I struggle to see the constitutionality of banning a social media platform. I get the reasoning behind the fear of maybe the Chinese are spying through phones, and maybe the national security claim is enough. Mike Leonard, your thoughts?
I'll bet there's a lot we don't know in terms of the national security threat or the alleged national security threat. I'm sure they're not giving us all that information. But I think the only reason I can see why it could pass constitutional muster is perhaps because it's a foreign company, right? It's not a U.S. company. We'd never get away with telling a U.S. company that they're banned, that we have to take them off, you know, absent some extraordinary circumstance. So perhaps the fact that it's a foreign company, and therefore what constitutional rights would they have, right?
Right.
What standing would they have to challenge a decision by us here that we're not going to allow them essentially on our phones, et cetera, since they're not a U.S.-based company? That would be my quick answer. It's still somewhat shocking that that would happen.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, and, you know, it's another issue. It's going to end up before the U.S. Supreme Court for sure. And, you know, with the makeup of the court, who knows? I mean, it's possible that they could uphold a ban given the makeup of the court right now.
Yeah, and also I think that you could maybe make national security claims there. I don't think this has to do with what Congress is also debating, which is how harmful are social media platforms in general for kids. There's a lot of discussion, and that goes well beyond TikTok. Meta has been called, Snapchat, all these sorts of companies have been called, and Congress is trying to work on new laws and legislation to protect children. This is completely separate from that. And it would be quite shocking. I wonder the political ramifications, although I guess if it's bipartisan, there's blame around both parties for
that. Well, certainly there will be retaliation of an economic sort by China. That seems clear. But I guess the overall question that maybe you have a constitutional scholar out there driving in their cars, listening intently to what we're saying, who aren't constitutional scholars, who can tell us how a foreign corporation would have standing to challenge the constitutionality in the U.S. courts. That seems to be the issue. Mm. And we don't seem to have the answer in this room, do we, Patrick?
I'm not sure. Okay. We do. No, but you raised an issue about national security, and that's, you know, that's a pretty strong argument. And there is a bunch of stuff that we clearly don't know behind that vote. I mean, when was the last time you saw a bipartisan vote like that?
50-0 in a committee? Not in a long time.
Shocking. Yeah.
We got a question, 708. I don't think we're gonna get to the phone lines here in a second, but just so you can start prepping for this, Patrick.
Sure.
The texter wants to know, if you're going to talk about anything legal, can you talk about the unionization of the Dartmouth basketball team? I hadn't heard about this.
I just heard that story this morning. Very interesting.
The prediction is it'll be appealed all the way to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. I mean, this kind of came up with Northwestern teams a few years ago. 708, we'll put that on the back burner. We'll tackle that after the news when we can all read up a little bit more on it. But let's start the grab bag. Let's open up the Let's Get Legal caller line. And
does that have anything to do with the Grinch, one of these questions?
Not yet. Let's go to Ron. We'll find out.
Not hey, revisiting that.
Ron, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine, sir.
What do you got?
My question is, I purchased a refrigerator here from an appliance store here. My daughter-in-law and I, apparently we misread the thing, and it said guarantee for 48 hours after your delivery. And the refrigerator conked out in about 96 hours, and the company or the store we purchased it from said that we had to go to the manufacturer to have it repaired. I was just wondering if this 48 hours, and if the warranty is only for 48 hours on a refrigerator.
Yeah, that seems crazy. That doesn't seem like a selling point. Like, oh, this fridge is guaranteed for 2 days.
Is it used, though? Is it a used item?
No, this is brand new. So they referred, it was a Frigidaire, and they referred me to the Frigidaire people, so the Frigidaire people then are the ones that have to repair the thing. And So this is a.
I mean, they only guaranteed it for 2 days. It worked for four. I mean, Ron, that's pretty good.
That's pathetic. That's unbelievable that anyone had a warranty to say that.
If this is legal, in other words, to me, the seller should have a little more responsibility for this rather than 48 hours, especially appliance and something like that.
Yeah, really. That's where I don't know. I don't know the ins and outs of.
I was going to say whatever the warranty says is probably enforceable, even though it's obviously not a great
doesn't
warranty.
Cover anything.
I don't think there's any
the
legal
argument
issue
that the warranty's unconscionable because if they're selling you a defective product and they say, "Oh, sorry guys, you only have 48 hours."
If it's a defective product,
yeah. I guess the big question is what is the nature of the issue with it? But that seems ludicrous that they could say a 48 hour. Warranty. It's like,
maybe
it's
we should talk about
nothing.
Who it was that he bought the fridge
no,
from.
We should not do that. Do not say that on the air. But Ron, I would say, I don't know if you have a legal claim, but I would just make as much noise as possible until they fixed it.
Well, I'm making all kinds of problems. I call my credit card company to discontinue
there we
the
go.
Thing.
That's
there
you go. Go. Yeah.
Naturally, it's too late. The Frigidaire people said that they wouldn't replace the thing. They would repair it. That's the only way. So now I'm here. It is about 3 weeks later. I'm still don't have a refrigerator. I had to buy a small one. And that.
Hold on, Ron. Get Iridium. Can you take down Ron's information? I'm going to call him and see if they want to do a news story on this one because that's ridiculous. That might help out with
Ron's
situation.
Yeah, probably would.
John Hansen is going Dave Savini.
I'm
going to outsource it to one of my reporters. Yeah.
Frigidaire, if you're listening, do the right thing.
You're in trouble.
No, someone from Channel 9 got, by the way, guys. So there you go.
I'm sorry.
I didn't say that name.
Yeah, there
you
go.
Talk about putting my foot in my mouth. Uh-oh.
Let's go to Mary online, too. Mary, what do you got for us?
Well, I'm one of four beneficiaries of an estate of a man who lived in New York, and the executor also lived in New York, and it's going on 5 years now.
Jeez.
I don't know if I have, I realize his estate was complicated, also complicated supposedly last year from the IRS, and that has been resolved. She has had surgery for an aneurysm, evidently recently, because I
the
was
executor
just
has had,
her
had,
today.
The executor's had surgery.
Yes.
So there might be some legitimate reasons for delay, but you still think it's just way too long, right?
It's into the fifth year. My two questions, do I have any legal rights as a beneficiary? There are four of us who are beneficiaries. It would be, a good sum of money.
Mm.
But it also, if all four of us died, because we're all in our 70s, if all four of us died, there is no provision in there for
who gets
for
a next?
Inheritance to, yeah, for
is
the
it
next
of
kin.
Is it a trust or is it a will?
It's a will.
I think it would. Well,
and it's New York.
You got a paper and pen near you, Mary?
I
want you to write down this number. I just talked about him a moment ago. I'll get these two guys' response in a second, too. You need to call John Heggie. His last name is Heggie. Okay? He's on this program a lot, and he knows everything about wills and trusts. And he may not know exactly what's happening in New York, but he will find out for you. You got that pen ready?
Yes, I do.
847-272-7360. Call him Monday morning. Okay. Tell him you called John and Let's Get Legal on WGN, and they'll chat with you, okay?
Okay, thank you.
And hang on, because I'll let these guys kind of take a slap at it. That doesn't seem right, but I know estates can take a while to go through the process.
They can. And last time I was on the show, John was on the show too, John Heggie.
Yeah.
And he was just amazing.
Yeah.
He answered everybody's questions. So I'm sure he'll be able to help.
Yeah, it just sounds a little bit suspicious. I mean, if the case is at court, I would actually try to get the court docket and see what's really going on. If it's not in court, I would probably want to get another lawyer to
get involved.
Either to say, hey, can you just what's look into on? This to see if this is really legit? Because it sounds fishy to me.
Yeah.
Would that be worth it for me to do that? Because obviously I'd have to pay another lawyer.
Yeah, but
that's the problem.
But if you're entitled to a lot of money and they can speed that up a little bit, that might be the best couple 500, couple grand that you spend. Even, and maybe John will even, I don't know if John will do it or I'll know someone will do it. It could be even just writing a letter and just moving that thing a little more officially along.
Yeah, you just need some answers. Yeah. And so that's the way to get them.
I've heard of people suing executors
for sure
for taking too much time.
For sure.
So that might be an option, Mary, okay?
Okay.
Sorry you're going through
that. Thank you.
Yeah, call John. I'm going to send John an email. Let him know you're going to call him too.
And also sometimes an attorney hearing from another attorney wakes them up and gets them to pay attention.
Right.
That's how we wake you up every Saturday morning.
Exactly.
There we go.
Exactly. Yeah, Dolan calls me and says, get into the
station.
Great
way to start your day, Mike, when I call.
If we don't follow the so-called Hansen rules.
Yeah, I'm turning your mics off in 3, 2, 1, because we got to get to the news on WGN. Thanks for joining us. It's Let's Get Legal. We are powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Mike Leonard to my left, Patrick Dolan to my right. Guy on my right, Patrick Dolan, does employment law. The guy to my left,
employment guy.
You are the employment guy.
Thanks.
And Mike's your guy who you call if the feds come knocking, or the state, Both of you are saved in my number for obvious reasons if I ever need you. But Mike, you're like at the top because I don't want to have to be thumbing through my phone.
No, you don't.
When the FBI is knocking,
right? And it's the difference when your boss comes knocking versus a
John. Yeah. If you're charged, are we allowed to report that on the air, or do we have to keep that silent?
We'll keep that silent.
Okay.
At least for we'll depend on what the charge.
Give him a buck, an attorney client.
Yeah. Speaking of that, would you like to address the Snyder U.S. Supreme Court appeal?
Perfect. Look at that transition. Right. Let's get Bill on the line. Bill, that's what you're asking about, right?
Yes, sir.
What do you want to know?
What are the ramifications of that going either way for the people in the Chicago area who are involved in corruption cases?
Interesting point. Mike, can you set it up for us here a little bit?
Yeah. So basically, Snyder was the mayor of Portage, Indiana.
James Snyder.
Yeah. Convicted of under the federal bribery statute.
Accepting a $13,000 bribe.
Correct. So that case was appealed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which it had to be. And then the U.S. Supreme Court has now taken cert, meaning they're going to hear the case. And the primary issue is, under the federal bribery statute, do the feds have to show essentially a quid pro quo, meaning I pay you to do something, right, versus if I give you a gratuity or something after the fact, after you've taken an action, is that sufficient to convict you of bribery, right?
Is this what pushed back the Madigan trial?
Correct. So it's already had ramifications here in Chicago in the sense that the ComEd 4, who've already gone to trial, their sentencing has been pushed back because they're waiting to see what the Supreme Court does. It's possible that case could be vacated or retried. And then also the Madigan case is being put on hold to see what the Supreme Court does in that case. So it's a real interesting issue. And, you know, for example, you know, it's easy for most people to see, hey, if I go to an official and say, hey, I'm going to give you 10 grand and, you know, pass this bill, I really need it passed. That seems obvious to us. However, the Snyder situation or situations analogous to it is where a politician does something and the argument is that the money paid to them or the gratuity given to them after the fact didn't induce the action. It shouldn't be considered bribery. It shouldn't be bribery under the federal bribery statute. So it could have big ramifications in these two major cases pending in Chicago. So it's going to be significant. Obviously, if it goes the way of the defense bar, that's great for the defendants in Common and Madigan. It's not going to mean those cases are done. If it goes the other way, it obviously supports the prosecution and the feds.
And the reason to delay the case is just, why have a decision that might be changed in June?
Correct. Now, for instance, the Madigan case. So some of the counts are directly impacted by this. Some of the counts are not. But why would you go ahead and try the case if you know the Supreme Court's about to rule on an important issue that's going to affect some of those counts? Some of those counts might go away. And so if you tried the case prematurely and the jury heard evidence that ends up being not relevant because those counts shouldn't have been tried, you're going to have to try the whole case over. Likewise, in the ComEd 4 sentencing, you're going to wait to see what the Supreme Court does before you sentence them because the convictions on some of those counts may get vacated, right? And so those people may have a new trial, so there's no need to sentence them. So it's definitely having an impact, and everyone's kind of in a wait-and-see posture right now.
So what if, so Mike, you know, you're still getting something for something, right? I mean, if you're going to take an action as a politician, and then you get a benefit from that, albeit after the fact, it's a little naive to think that you had no idea that you're going to get that benefit. But you're,
it'd be another layer to prove. You'd have to prove that
exactly.
That person
knew it was coming. You could say that about anything at any time, right? And you sound much like a federal prosecutor, Patrick. So we might have to disqualify you from the show. But that's an argument that the feds would make, certainly. But it's tough because if they receive any benefit or gratuity after the fact, there can be absolutely no connection to the action taken. But yet you say it's a bribe. So to me, I like the defense argument better than the prosecution's argument.
I don't know. Walks like a duck. So. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to say. I don't know.
Bill, did that answer your question, my friend?
Yeah. I'm involved in something similar, but not as high profile, obviously.
Do you need a lawyer?
For any of this?
All right.
I'm sorry?
Do you need Mike Leonard services?
I've acquired a pretty good attorney at this point.
And now you've got my brain wondering.
No,
don't
solicitation,
say
John. No solicitation allowed on the show.
Okay, sorry. Okay, the timeline, probably June, right? I would assume that's when they release their opinions, throughout June.
I don't know if it'll be that quick. Yeah, it could be this summer. It could be this fall. I mean, it's hard to tell.
Well, they're going to hear the case this term, right?
I don't know the answer to that. Yeah,
we'll look it up.
They're busy with a bunch of Trump stuff right now.
Well, they're not. They're waiting till April to hear those. So,
I was saying about June opinions.
Bill, let me look at the docket and see if we have a timeline for it. Okay.
I certainly appreciate everything. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Good luck with everything. Now, I have a lot more questions for Bill.
Yeah.
Hope it works out for him. Patrick, I've got a couple employment questions for you. 708, this one, just get this timeline in your head.
Go ahead.
This person retired in July of 2023, so last year they retire. In September, so a couple months later, the 3% cost of living raise came through for the dates retroactively from December to December of 22,
right,
while that person was still working,
right,
till September 23.
Mm-hmm.
So they would think that they are entitled to 8 months of a retro check covering December 2022 till the retirement date. The department head is telling me that you have to be an active employee to receive one. I previously discussed this with that person prior to me retiring. He didn't say anything at all. Do I have a right to that check that covers the time that I was actually working there?
I believe so, yes. Okay, that's the short answer. Who told him he was not? Who did he say?
He said that it was department head.
Oh, his company's department head is not. Yeah, I don't agree with that.
Go to HR. First and foremost,
I'm happy to talk with him because I think he is entitled to those monies. Yes.
312-332-7800.
Just read your arm.
I have a tattoo.
Right? Underneath a fancy jacket. Pull that sleeve up.
I'm texting the person back your phone number as well. Because that doesn't seem right.
No,
if you were working during it, especially a cost of living where people routinely retire during the middle of these periods that are, it seems like a routine thing.
That happens all the time, right? And we'll also look at the retirement plan docs to see what they say. But no, he's going to be entitled to those monies.
Another one for you before we get to Claire on the phone line. My daughter sustained a work injury due to her manager not wanting to put an anti-slip mat where it belongs. She slipped once before, and I told her this is dangerous area. Supposed to have a mat there. The manager still refused to put one down. Eventually she slipped again. She had a serious injury. We saw the workers' comp doctors. They eventually sent her back to work with restrictions which weren't honored by her manager. She eventually re-injured the original injury. She's been working with an attorney since October. This happened in September, so she could recoup 40% of the income she's not receiving. This is going on 6 months now. She has to have surgery. I feel like this is the corporation she worked responsibly for. Attorney representative says it's an entirely different thing. I thought I would just ask the question about the differences. That sounds like a workers' comp case.
Well, it's a work comp case, yeah.
That's the difference. It could be right, but then there could also be negligence and ADA issues too, but it does sound like a workers' comp issue.
Yeah, so if you're injured at work, your remedy is against the employer through the work comp system. However, there are cases where there's some other cause of it. Say you get your arm chopped off in a machine. You still have your negligence comp case, but you might have a negligence claim against the manufacturer of the machine. But sounds like
or against the employer for not maintaining their workplace.
Yeah. So, I'm just telling her to call the folks over at Theriault.
I was going to say Ryan Theriault.
Yeah.
Yep.
Theriault. Ryan Theriault was the Cubs player.
The name looks the same. That's
very,
what I said.
Very deceptive.
Oh, my gosh. I've been calling his name wrong the whole time.
Theriault.
Probably get some business, though, right?
Yeah, Theriault.
You know, they think he's connected to the Cubs guy.
Yeah. He's a great guy.
Theriault Booth. I just sent them the text for that number as well. Okay, Claire, hang on. We're going to get to you after this break here on 720 WGN. WGN, Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Mike Leonard, Patrick Dolan, John Hansen here in this chair. I'm the one that's not the lawyer, though I take pretty good guesses, guys.
No,
I think Patrick, he acts more like a lawyer than
us. We do, right?
You know, yeah.
Certainly
yeah.
looks more like one today.
He looks right. like a lawyer. Yeah, he acts like a lawyer. He talks like a lawyer on the show.
Let's go to Claire on the phone line. She's got a legal problem. We're going in the grab bag. Claire, what do you got for us?
What I have is that I live in Wisconsin. My daughter lives in California, and she has just had her identity stolen.
Oh, no.
Yes.
How badly? Did you get a letter in the mail, or did money get taken out of accounts? What happened?
Well, a lot of things have happened with her, but the fortunate thing is that no money has been withdrawn from her accounts. The bank that has her mortgage lent it or
sold it, right?
They sold it. Was stolen by someone else that she wasn't aware of. Her credit cards have all been attacked. Accounts have been changed under, she believes, a fake person.
Mm-hmm.
She has done so many things. She is at her wit's end, is contemplating notifying the FBI. I'm just trying to help her.
Yeah, no, you sound, what a great mom you are, Claire, mm-hmm. to call in and ask.
Oh.
And that's a horrifying situation. I've had my identity stolen just in a breach, not to the level that Claire's daughter has, where you're just everything keeps on getting pinged. I'm glad no money is gone. And so she's probably Claire. I'm assuming she's frozen her credit lines at the three major bureaus.
I think she's in the process of doing that.
Okay.
If not, she has already done it, but that is on her mind.
Yeah, and I just want to remind people out there, and I'm sure, Claire, your daughter probably has done it. She seems really proactive about this. If you're ever freaked out, and honestly, Patrick, you do this too, I just go to Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion. I freeze all those three credit lines, and I only open them up, unfreeze them when I had to buy my house and wanted to get that line of credit.
Mine are always frozen.
Yeah.
And by the way, my identity was stolen a couple of years ago. Someone tried to buy a house and get a mortgage using my identity. Honestly, it was a nightmare.
Oh, yeah.
But I had to I closed everything. I mean, it was none of it was the same after that occurred.
I've talked to credit people, like, will it ding you in any way if you just have those closed or frozen, all the time? And it doesn't.
There's no
penalty to unfreeze them.
I think they should always. I think people should freeze those all the time.
Right. And it's actually a pretty easy switch. You got to be a little internet savvy. I mean, essentially just use a website, right?
Yeah, you just have to go to their website and remember to keep your password because sometimes they're pretty complicated.
Right.
And then literally you just like click on something, it's
hit
frozen.
A button. Yeah, exactly.
It's really.
And I'm not blaming anyone who gets their identity. It happens
of course
to everyone.
Not. I'm just saying people don't know.
Claire, we have so many guests. I mean, you probably listen to WGN a lot. We have so many guests that say it's only a matter of time before this happens to you. As to going to the FBI, Mike, any thoughts on that? I mean, you can always ping them at least, right?
Well, you can certainly report identity theft fraud to state law enforcement and federal law enforcement. There's actually federal statutes under which someone could be prosecuted and state statutes under which someone could be prosecuted. The likelihood that they're going to be able to investigate and find the person in this particular instance is probably incredibly slim. However, there's no harm in reporting it to law enforcement. And, you know, it might be part of a greater pattern that they might be investigating already. But yeah, it's a long shot, but certainly you definitely have those options.
Or they might have a tip or two on what to do next.
Yeah,
right?
actually my bank, you went to the authorities and they traced who was actually trying to open the account.
Mm.
It was someone overseas, a hacker who was trying to do this. And so the bank really was aggressive in working with the state authorities to take care of that.
That's great.
Yep.
Claire, I would have your daughter, and again, what a nice mom to call a show here in Chicago.
It's so stressful.
I bet Claire's going to call her daughter here soon. I would say, reach out to the federal authorities. There's got to be a California State Regulatory Commission on that sort of stuff as well. Make those phone calls. Stay aggressive. Maybe they'll, like Mike said, maybe they're investigating as part of a broader trend, and maybe they'll be able to offer some assistance. This too shall pass. Claire,
could you narrow it down as to what local or federal agencies she should contact?
Where are you guys? Where is she located? What jurisdiction?
She's in California.
She's in Antioch.
Okay,
just
so
south of Sacramento.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in California. Yeah. Okay, so whatever the county prosecutor's office is in that jurisdiction, and also in that district, I'm not sure which one it's in, but from a federal standpoint, whatever district you're in, you could contact the U.S. Attorney's Office or the FBI office in that particular jurisdiction in California.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I would call the prosecutor's office in the county, right? I mean, and at least report it. They may guide you to the right place. Mike, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you whatever local law enforcement is, it has jurisdiction over that area, and then same thing on the federal side. There's always going to be a regional FBI office within some distance of there, and there's also going to be a United States Attorney's Office, which maybe would be easier to put you in contact with the FBI. But those are options for you, and we wish you guys luck because that's a tough one.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Claire. Yes. Okay.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Yeah, text or call back in if you find out a solution, Claire. She's wonderful. She sounds like such a nice
I know.
Mom.
She's trying to help. It's really stressful.
Got a lot more questions on the line. I do have the Dartmouth thing, but I don't want to start it now because we have just a couple minutes before the break. So to our Dartmouth texter, you and I and Patrick, we've all chatted about it during a break. We have thoughts. 847, question for Patrick. My husband works for a national furniture store. His hourly wage is $11 plus a 2% incentive. He's been told that they add the two amounts to come to his hourly rate. Is that legal? Huh. So it almost seems like a sub-minimum wage situation like you see at restaurants.
Yeah, but it can be. I mean, it depends how much he's making. Is it a 2% commission? Is that what it is?
That's what I would guess.
Yeah, so it depends how, you know, what happens week after week in terms of how much he actually takes home and how much he makes. That's the whole issue in Illinois.
Because at the end of the day, he needs to make that minimum wage.
You have
even
to.
If his commission isn't getting to that, they have to close
100%,
the gap.
100%. And it's not like the situation of, you know, like a waiter or waitress. That's a different situation. We're really adding, you know, the commission plus the hourly wage must meet minimum wage. There's no sub minimum wage that, you know, like a makeup portion entitled that the employer is entitled to, like there is for some wait staff. He's a commission person working at a furniture store. Is that what you said? Is that what you said?
I feel like he should be making the minimum wage there.
No. Yes, I totally agree. But
in addition to the 2%,
maybe not though. It depends. Not necessarily. It depends how much he is paid consistently over time for those commissions.
So will you say that depends. If those commissions get over the threshold to who he is, if you add the two together,
yes,
$11 an hour, and he consistently is making enough of the commission, then it's okay.
Then in Illinois, remember, it's a weekly thing, 40 hours a week. It's not a daily overtime thing. So minimum wage, you have to, you know, look at the hours and all that kind of stuff and look at it in an aggregate.
What if there's a week or two where he falls below it? Are they supposed to make up the difference or no?
No. Employers have a little bit of a leeway, but that cannot happen more than like once or twice. You know, minimum wage are super strict. You have to pay someone that minimum wage, which, you know, is like about $4 more than he's making, roughly. I can't imagine he doesn't make that commissions. But if there are times when he doesn't, then that's a problem, certainly on a consistent basis.
All right. You got 1 minute to answer this one. This is a good one. 847. I'm in my late 50s. I work for blank. I'm not going to say that. They're not training me in other areas, but they are training newer, less experienced, and much younger employees. Is that age discrimination?
Could be, for sure. If you're treated differently in terms of training, absolutely.
So it doesn't have to be just pay?
No. Oh, no. It could be in any sort of thing related to your job. Most of the time, frankly, it's not pay. That's pretty obvious. A lot of time it is training, benefits, you know, opportunities for growth, et cetera, et cetera. That's where a lot of age discrimination comes into play.
312-332-7800 is how they can reach you, right?
Yep, that's right.
Sorry, Mike, you've been silent for 3 minutes. That's a new record.
It's very tough for me. I'm falling asleep over here, John.
We'll get questions for you, I promise. We'll do it after this break in the news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on Let's Get Legal on WGN.
Hey.
Everything okay over there, Patrick?
I'm sorry. The chair was an issue with the chair. I'm fine.
Did you just break the chair?
No, maybe. It's possible.
Let me call off air, Patrick. You might have a claim.
No,
negligence.
Don't say that.
I think John set it up poorly or something.
I got
it. It was not Iridian's fault. That much I know.
It never is producer Iridian's fault. We got Patrick Dolan, employment lawyer. We got Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney and whistleblower. And we have a question from a texter that kind of fits both of your worlds. They want to know, the 224, are OSHA whistleblowers exposed or are they kept anonymous? I see so many safety violations at work. It's sickening. Our boss doesn't care. I work for a municipal. And OSHA stands for Occupational Safety and Health Administration, which I did absolutely not have to Google before I said that.
Good.
Wow. Impressive, John.
What do you guys think?
Definitely you can do it anonymously. Mm-hmm. You could choose to not do it anonymously, but most people, of course, proceed anonymously. And also, whistleblowers have protection under OSHA. If you were fired in response to making a complaint, you have a retaliation case.
Right. Okay.
But no, I agree. That's right. And
what if you are discovered, Patrick, and there's retribution given to you at work?
Then you might have the best claim you have. I mean, retaliation claims are usually the best. So any kind of job detriment you suffer as a result of that claim is going to be a retaliation claim under OSHA, which also protects that.
What about other claims you might have, whistleblower claims that aren't necessarily OSHA violations, but are maybe violations of laws? You feel like someone's doing something wrong in your company in a big way, defrauding the government. Mike, maybe, what are the protections for people?
Yeah, so whistleblower cases are of many stripes. Okay, first of all, in Illinois, you have what's called a common law claim for retaliatory discharge, meaning I make a complaint about something, including an OSHA violation, I get fired, I was a whistleblower, I brought that, you know, internally or externally to the attention of the company or enforcement officials, and I get fired. That type of whistleblowing is recognized in Illinois. There's also a statute, Illinois whistleblower statute, that protects you. So if you're fired or experience material change in your job because of being a whistleblower, you have protections, which is great.
In private companies.
Correct, in private companies. Okay. Also, the kind of whistleblower cases we deal with a lot are when the government's being defrauded, right? Mm-hmm. And those are also called QUITAM cases, Q-U-I. T-A-M.
Quitam?
Quitam. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it goes all the way back to the time of Lincoln during the Civil War where suppliers and vendors would rip off the federal government. So they came up with a statute that basically rewards and incentivizes whistleblowers to come forward and report fraud upon the government. So this comes up a lot. There's a lot of whistleblower healthcare fraud cases, for example. So someone may call us up, say, hey, I work at this healthcare company. They bill Medicare, or they bill Medicaid, and sometimes even private insurers. We don't have to get into that today. And essentially, here's how they're ripping off Medicare or Medicaid, which are governmental entities. And you get to file a lawsuit under seal, meaning secret, so no one sees it. The defendant doesn't see it. The government officials see it. They get to investigate the claim and decide if they want to either try to negotiate with the company to settle it or to go ahead and litigate the case and make it a public case. But what happens most of the time is the government takes a look at your case, no matter how good or bad it is. They will pass. They will say, we don't want to litigate the case. You go ahead, attorney, with your client. Go ahead and litigate the case. It then becomes a public case.
And you're essentially litigating for the government at that
point.
Yeah,
so it's like, for instance, John Hansen in the name of the United States versus healthcare company X, right?
Okay.
And so the reason why the governmental lawyers typically decline and let you go ahead and litigate it is because the whistleblower is entitled to up to 30% of the recovery, which can be millions of dollars, but the government gets usually 70% or more, so they can sit back, let the attorney litigate the case for 2, 3, 4 years, and they're still going to get their 70%, which is beautiful for them, and they don't have the resources and time to litigate all these cases. So that's a lot of the ways in which federal whistleblower cases come to us, and the same thing applies at the state level. For instance, John Hansen comes to me. His company has a contract with the state of Illinois. It doesn't have to be healthcare. It could be for anything. They're ripping off the state of Illinois. They're not providing them with the services they're billing for. They're overbilling, misbilling, whatever it is, whatever the fraud is. Same thing applies. We file the case under seal. Then Illinois law enforcement prosecutors on the civil side would look at the case, decide if they want to take it over. If they don't want to take it over, we litigate the case in state court. And so right now we have some of those cases going in state court and some going in federal court.
Do they, if they take it over because it's a slam dunk and it's an easy case, is that why they would take the case, do you think?
Well, the cases they typically take are the really good ones. So, for instance,
good headlines, like,
yeah, like let's say you have a $500 million case against some company that's ripping off the federal government for Medicare fraud, and they really like the allegations. They're sexy. They're easily provable. Your client has great evidence that's been provided to them. So they view it as a slam dunk. And also, from a publicity standpoint, makes them look really good.
Does the whistleblower get any money if they win, if they take it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, okay.
So let's say a whistleblower files a case under seal. The government loves the case. And they say, hey, we're taking this over. We're going to litigate it and either take it to judgment, you know, by trial or settle it. The whistleblower still gets a share of the money because they brought the case. The government wouldn't know about the case but for the filing.
Okay, good.
But you're likely to get less of the up to 30% because you're not doing all that work.
Okay.
But you're still going to get a handsome reward.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I think a lot, it's a great summary, Mike.
Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, you're welcome.
John didn't compliment, but thank you.
No,
maybe because you're a fellow attorney,
well,
you appreciate our work
a little
bit more than John.
I think this is just the penance you pay because you stand up to the government so much that you feel a little bad, and now you want to help the government out by helping prosecute those whistleblower claims.
Wow. I don't think so. It's ultimate little guy again. So, for instance, in the whistleblower cases, again, you're representing the little guy against the man, which is the employer, or the defrauder. You don't have to be employed by the company to bring the whistleblower case.
Okay.
However, most of the time, the person with the most direct firsthand knowledge of what's going on is someone inside the company, oftentimes has privy to billing records or just great evidence.
But you are still helping the government, Mike Leonard.
Indirectly, John. But
you won't even admit that you helped the government a little bit.
There's nothing wrong with that.
In this case.
Yeah, in this case.
What were you going to say, Patrick, by the way?
I was going to say is, you know, and thinking about which cases they take, they also want, if there's a larger issue that they want to press, kind of like the EEOC deciding which cases to litigate,
yes.
If they want to send a broader message about the enforcement of, say, prohibition of age discrimination or something like that, they tend to pick and choose cases that they really want to have a larger impact on. That's the same with those kind of cases.
I actually think it's kind of a clever setup that the government has worked out. There is an incentive to report. You can make a lot of money if you report something.
Right.
The government will then let you do most of the work to save them some money and time and energy.
Yeah.
It's kind of a rare everybody wins, except the company, but they shouldn't because they're the ones defrauding the government.
Yeah, and the company shouldn't win if they're the bad guy. Yeah, I think it's a pretty good system. I mean, the reason why also the government prosecutors, they're on the civil side. So, for instance, if we filed a federal whistleblower suit in Chicago in federal court under seal, and then it's litigated if it comes out of seal, the civil prosecutors from U.S. Attorney's Office, they're the ones that look at the case and decide if they want to take it. On the state side, the AG's office, or it could even be a county prosecutor, depending upon the allegations, is looking at that, making that decision. But typically, they just don't have the resources. So let's say they have a really big case. They're not going to want to devote 2, 3, 4 lawyers and a lot of money out of pocket, potentially, to litigate the case when they can stand on the sidelines and essentially get a same good result for their jurisdiction, so to speak.
In the similar analysis is in securities fraud cases. You know, it's a different. Obviously, it's a different concern, but it's the same sort of scheme and setup with regard to those actions too.
Yeah. So someone who's working for a publicly traded company can file a whistleblower case again anonymously. However, SEC does know who they are, which is good, and then they can share in their recovery. If there's a recovery by settlement or by an award.
I got to ping both you guys before the break, though. You both used acronyms. I'm on acronym police. Okay. AG, Attorney General.
AG equals Attorney General, yes.
SEC.
Securities and Exchange Commission.
And Patrick, EEOC.
Equal Employment Opportunity Commission.
Yeah.
They
remember,
enforce
guys,
federal employment laws.
We're not all lawyers here. You got to remind
John,
us.
I got one for you. BLT. It's a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich. John, wrong.
Now I'm hungry. Quick break, then more on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association on WGN. Mike Leonard, our federal defense attorney here, also helps out with whistleblower cases. Patrick Dolan, who is an employment lawyer. Based on our conversation we just had about whistleblowers, Mike, someone wanted to know, can I be a whistleblower even if I'm a former employee of a government entity and I feel like there have been some deceptive practices for hiring an employee, and is there a time limit? I think I'd want to know more specifics about the case, but just generally speaking, what do you think?
Yeah, so this is a good question for both of us, Patrick and I. I'm not going to hog the mic this time, Patrick.
But thanks, Mike.
Just
we'll
so
keep
everyone,
it short, please.
Just so listeners know where it come from, you can whistleblow about anything to anyone, right? You have the right to complain internally or externally or to a governmental entity about anything you want to, and that could constitute whistleblowing. It's just what we're talking about, the two kind of frameworks we've talked about are, one, if I'm an employee and I complain, I whistleblower, what happens to me, what's my rights as a whistleblower if they fire me or take action against me. And the other one was, hey, if I bring forward fraud against a governmental entity, how can I, you know, not only do the right thing but get paid for it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, but whistleblowing is broader than that. You know, anyone can whistleblower, meaning bring to whoever they want's attention, things that they think are evidence of wrongdoing. Could be a violation of law or policy or whatever. So there are some situations where you may not get any personal benefit out of it, but of course you can whistleblow. But Patrick can answer this more specific employment-related one as a former employee, what you can do and what you would get out of it or not get out of it.
Yeah, it's really, okay, so let's just set the stage. Anybody can file a claim of any sort of, you know, wrongdoing under federal law with the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, within 300 days of the, you know, whatever happened to them, that was maybe they were fired or something like that, or demoted, whatever the action is. But when you file that claim, that has to be related to what happened to you. To Mike's point, if you want to bring something to the attention of the EEOC about an unfair hiring practice, something that discriminates, that's fine. But if you were not impacted by it, I mean, that would be frankly rather unusual to do that. But the EEOC can investigate anything it wants. It just, there are very strict timelines as to when a person can file that claim. 300 days.
Okay.
But if you're a federal employee, for instance, if you're either there or gone, you could still make a complaint hypothetically to the OIG.
You could.
And they
What's
could,
the OIG?
Office of Inspector General, and they might or might not investigate your claims. I mean, just because you're a former employee doesn't mean you can't make that complaint. Whether it go anywhere, who knows? But that's why you have the Office of Inspector General, if you're a federal employee, to look into any kind of wrongdoing, whether you're still employed or not. And sometimes people are more comfortable after they leave making those kinds of complaints.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Let's talk about Dartmouth really quickly. Someone texted in right at the start of the show an hour and a half ago. I hope they're still with us. Dartmouth basketball players have won a victory in a regional NLRB, National Labor Relations Board. The director there saying essentially, yes, they can unionize. In fact, they voted 13-2 to join a union. If this sounds familiar, it's because it happened here locally. Northwestern voted their football team wanted to unionize in 2015. A regional director of the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, said yes. It then went to the national, the full NLRB, who rejected that. This opens up a lot of interesting avenues of discussion and a lot of different points because Dartmouth, of course, a private Ivy League school where scholarships are not given out and there's not that maybe claim to compensation that public school employees or other schools that offer scholarships have. But just broadly speaking, did I sum that up, Mike Leonard, and your thoughts?
Yeah, and the underpinning, which Patrick will get into too, the underpinning of that finding is that they're employees of the university because they're on the team, okay? Whether I'm speaking as a lawyer or non-lawyer, I don't buy that, right? They're members of a basketball team who happen to go to Dartmouth. They don't get a scholarship. To say because they're members of the team, they're employees of the university, I personally don't buy it, and it kind of bothers me. What's the difference between, and this kind of huge ramifications, mm-hmm. you know? So let's look at if someone's kid goes to a Division III school, no scholarship, some fantastic small liberal arts college in the Midwest, and they play Division III basketball. And so this ruling would apply to any team who could vote to unionize, and then they get to tell their coach. Negotiate with their coach of what hours they're going to have practice and what's going to be served at the training table. I don't know. I just feel like it's something going amok here.
Okay, well, hold on. Let me challenge you for one thing. Let's say it wasn't a school that didn't offer scholarships. Let's say it was a University of Illinois, Northwestern, something like that, that does offer scholarships. Do they have a stronger claim to try and say that they are employees and should be able to unionize? Or does that still rub you the wrong way?
It still rubs me the wrong way, but I could see more of the argument. You know, it really is more of a contractual relationship. You know, I'm going to give you a scholarship worth anywhere from $50,000 to $100,000 per year, and I'm going to have a lot of control over your life, but you get a great benefit from me giving you that scholarship. But I'd be more comfortable saying that the scholarship is the benefit, and it's a contractual relationship. It doesn't make you an employee. But you have essentially a contract, and if you decide to go to that school and accept their contract and play sports for them and get all these great benefits, I don't see the need to say you get to negotiate with your coach over your practice schedule and things of that nature. That's just me.
Do you feel like you have a little cover in your argument now that the NIL, the idea that they can make for their image and likeness and their name, they can make money off of that? Does that give you a little cover in your argument by saying that they can still get some financial benefit outside of the scope of being an employee at the university?
Yeah, well, number one, they get, whether they get NIL money or not, which is name, image, likeness, folks, whether they get a penny of that, they're still getting a huge benefit with their academics paid for,
right,
their housing paid for, their food, travel, all those things. So they're still getting a lot of economic benefit. In addition to that, they get to go earn money. If someone wants their likeness or name on a product or a commercial, they can make, in some instances, millions of dollars. So I don't view them as employees, and that may rub Patrick the wrong way.
Well, yeah, 45 seconds before the news, yeah, you can finish it afterwards.
Yeah, so it's all about control, right? I mean, when you're talking about whether someone's an employee versus, say, an independent contractor, the question is, are they being controlled by the person who heads the, you know, heads the work that they're doing? And here, there's a lot of indications that they are being controlled. So, listen, I understand your point. The problem is the ramifications are considerable. When we're talking about all the college sports teams, this is the first unionized college sports team, okay? Mm-hmm. And so how does that impact Title IX? All men and women college sports teams, can they be unionized now? And, you know, what's the relationship between public and private universities? So these are huge thorny issues.
They are huge thorny issues. And let's not forget that schools, individuals at schools, and directors of these leagues are making millions and billions of dollars.
Tens of millions, right.
Yeah, I'm not
off of the students and
I'm turning Mike's mic off before he can even say anything. Okay. Let's take a break here for the news. We'll pick this up on the other side. I'd love your thoughts, too. 312-981-7200. Would it weird you out if college sports teams were able to unionize and be labeled employees? We'll do that after this. I literally had to stop Mike Leonard and Patrick Dolan, my two guests today, from continuing to fight off the air because I want to have this fight or argument discussion respectfully on the air. We're talking about Dartmouth. Their basketball team has voted to unionize. The regional director of their area and the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, says thumbs up. Same thing happened to Northwestern when the football team wanted to be treated as employees. The NLRB said sure. And then the National NLRB later said, no, we don't know what's going to happen with Dartmouth. And then this has a lot. The Dartmouth case is interesting because they don't get scholarships, which does muddy this a little bit. But I want to just broaden out, generally speaking, Mike Leonard, millions upon billions of dollars are made off of college athletes. Why can't we just simply, every college athlete gets paid minimum wage for the hours that they practice, the hours that they're in the game, the hours that they're traveling? It's not a ton of money, but it would divvy out the money that I think that they deserve. Yes, they get scholarships.
Not all of them.
And scholarships wonderful.
Most don't.
But scholarships are not cash in your pocket. And a lot of kids that play sports, broadly speaking, don't have a lot of cash in their pocket when they show up. They're working jobs that people are making millions and billions off of.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a couple different issues there. So the narrow issue with Dartmouth is the finding that they're employees, okay? I just don't buy that the Dartmouth basketball team are employees of the university. I have no problem this other issue of whether they can be paid. That's an NCAA issue. The NCAA rules don't allow straight compensation like that. So that's a different issue.
Would you be okay if they did?
Sure. I mean, it's already really happening in an indirect way in that under these NIL deals, people can make and are making, in some instances, several million dollars.
But not
everybody.
You're talking about the exception, not the rule.
Yeah.
And by the way, a minute. It's okay that they're paid, but not okay that they can unionize? Is that what you just said?
Because they're not employees.
If they're employees, why can't they unionize?
They're not employees.
Hold on, why are they not?
But you just said it's okay if they're paid. I have no problem with them paid.
I have no problem with them getting paid, but that's an NCAA rule.
Okay. But John said minimum wage. Why aren't they paid minimum wage?
That's not an NLRB issue. It's an NCAA issue. The NCAA, which governs college sports, doesn't allow that right now. So that could get changed, and it seems like if the NCAA allows people on teams to get In some instances, millions of dollars. Why does the NCAA not allow schools just to pay them directly? I agree with that.
Okay, but then
it doesn't make them employees in the Dartmouth concept.
But if you're paid directly for your time, if it's done in an hourly way or a stipend way, you're paid for your time. You're expected to show up. There's rules and regulations about how you can be kicked off the team, why you can be brought on. You're essentially
when you come, when you go,
you sign a contract or an agreement to be with. That's an employee at that point.
No, it's a guy who has wants to play on a team who has a contract with the university, which is called a scholarship.
Yeah, that just ignores, first of all, most college athletes are not on scholarships. Even at the Big Ten, even like the soccer teams, they're not all on scholarships.
Oh, no, not all, but they all get a percentage.
Most college athletes do not get a dime of nil money. Okay, the vast majority of college athletes do not have a scholarship, but yet they're all controlled by the university in terms of how they spend their time, what they're doing, why they're doing, who they're doing it for.
Yeah, I want to give Mike some time here because you do bring up good points about the ramifications of this, of a union negotiating with coaches or the administration. Walk us through that.
Yeah, well, first of all, to Patrick's point, all Division I athletes, unless they're in the Ivies, they do get scholarships. They're eligible.
Not every team.
I understand. Like, for instance, there might be, and there is,
most
on a regular basis,
not.
Like, let's say a soccer
Patrick,
team.
Let him answer. This is not the Grinch debate.
Soccer teams
wrong.
Might give an eighth of scholarship, a quarter scholarship, whatever. I get it. They're all the sports that don't generate as much revenue as the others. I agree with you on that point. But here's where I come from. It's not a legal issue. It's not a union issue. To me, it's like, hey, you choose to play college sports on a team. You're not an employee. It's a choice. You don't become an employee of the university because you choose to play sports for their team. That's the basic
difference.
You're
making like the old school argument.
It's old school. I'm a little old school in that way. But you got to remember, the NCAA is the one that sets the rule about people not getting compensated directly. That's not an NLRB union issue. That's the NCAA, which it no longer makes any sense for the NCAA to say, hey, kid, you can make $5 million through NIL deals. That's fine. You can do television commercials, radio ads, and get paid. But yet, the average rank and file member of the team, the university can't give you money. That makes no sense.
So
but doesn't make them employees.
So you kind of halfway agree with me. You think that a stipend or a regular paycheck, and obviously, Patrick, you brought up this would bring up Title IX considerations. I say all student-athletes of every sport,
so I understand
men's and women's, issues. But you just don't want to cross the line of that then they're employees because you fear what could happen. Because you mentioned in the break, if they unionize, they would have so much leverage over their coaches because what? The team's not going to field the team?
Yep,
they
won't. That's not what's going to happen.
But like, come on. The kids are going to dictate to the coach.
Do you think they're
going to
have more leverage over the university, like one sports team?
Maybe.
Well, yeah, in some instances, yeah. But
if it's football or basketball.
If the team decides they're an impasse, and they're not going to take the field because they can't reach agreement, the university cannot get rid of them under the NLRB rules. That would be a retaliation, and that would be a failure to bargain. So,
hold on.
All of a sudden, you're going to have these kids telling the coach, hey, coach, we're not going to lift at 7 a.m. We're only going to lift for a half hour. It has to be at 4 p.m. Let a coach do his job.
Okay, hold on.
That's old school.
Patrick, I've had to turn off your mic a couple times because we don't talk over people in this room because it's the radio, and everyone's going to turn it off if we're all yelling at each other. I got a question from the 708 about this to Mike Leonard. But the student working in the cafeteria at minimum wage is an employee. Their taxes are taken out. Isn't this the same thing? You're working for the betterment of the university. You should be compensated as such.
No, you're talking about a group of people who want to play on a team versus someone who has a job. And when you have a job and you're an employee, I get it. You should be paid and you should have input in the terms and conditions of your employment. I just disagree with Patrick and maybe some of the listeners. I don't think that because you're on a sports team, that makes you an employee.
I think most of the listeners, for the record, will agree with you, Mike Leonard. We've done this topic on WGN before, not as spirited as this. So I think actually Patrick and I are climbing up a steeper hill. Patrick, what were you going to say?
Well, I just think it's control. It's the same control of the athlete versus the guy who works in the cafeteria. You know what I mean? I mean, you're still controlling what the person does. And if you're talking about who's an employee, that's issue number one. That's question number one. Do you control these people? Yes, you do. But it's all a part of negotiation. To think that the the team and individual members of the team are going to have so much power that they can tell the coach when and how long they're going to practice. That's just unrealistic.
Plus,
that's unrealistic.
Isn't this the free market in that schools that seem to be maybe more friendly to their teams and more let the teams have a little bit more control would be attractive landing points, and universities are then going to have to compete over each other of who treats their student athletes, employees better.
But that already exists, and there is actually a transfer portal. So at the division level, Division I level, which we should really focus on because that's really where these union issues seem to come into play, people can transfer. They can get out of their scholarship. It's not like 20 years ago where if an athlete went to university, they couldn't get out of their scholarship. They couldn't transfer to a team within their conference, all those sorts of things. Now there's a transfer portal, and people regularly, even after 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, whatever, they put themselves in a transfer portal and they go to another school, not only to win, but because they think they like the coach or they like whatever, and they can go to another school. So you're free to go anywhere you want and go sign up for any other team.
Last argument, though. These D1 schools are making millions of dollars from the tickets sold.
Tens or hundreds of millions.
To the TV rights that are sold. They are all done on the backs of the student athletes right now. The coaches make millions of dollars. And a student there, yeah, maybe a couple of them get an NIL deal that gets them higher, but the third string offensive lineman is not getting a big NIL deal. Maybe they get the scholarship, and that might be worth, over the course of 4 years, okay, $100,000. Still not millions where other people are making. Why do they not get any of the... They are making the product.
The only reason they don't is because the NCAA, which exercises jurisdiction over them, says they can't.
Okay, so you're giving me a legalese here. Let's say
that's the answer. That is the true answer. It's not because if schools were allowed to pay people, they would. NCAA says they can't, which is ludicrous.
I'm asking you what you think should happen. Let's say the NCAA said it's up to Mike Leonard.
The NCAA should say they can pay their players.
Okay.
Absolutely.
But not form a union.
Okay, that's Mike Leonard's thought. Patrick Dolan with the biggest eye roll I've ever seen. But good spirit of debate.
I'm just concerned about those athletes who aren't big ticket Division I sports athletes. The women's sports teams, the Division III athletes.
Well, Mike said that they can get, if the NCAA lets them get paid, they should get paid, and they get paid.
Yeah, maybe they won't. But anyway, my point is they need the ability to bargain more than the folks who can transfer around and get all this nil money.
Fair.
It's a totally different ball.
Okay, we got to take a break. Okay. And we got Rebecca waiting. She's got her comments too. Great spirited debate. Pretty good, guys. I only had to turn off Patrick Dolan mics three times during that.
Wow. You'd be a good judge, John.
Yeah, for sure.
All usually, right, I would be being silenced, though.
Yeah, right. Well, let me do that right now. We'll be back after this on WGN. Well, you guys haven't gotten that spirited since we debated whether the Grinch was guilty or not of a crime. That was fun.
It was a wrong decision.
Patrick, still just as wrong as he was back then.
Yeah, all right. So we've been talking about Dartmouth. By the way, the texter who brought this up followed up. His name is Jim Ayu. He's a huge fan of WGN, one of our super fan listeners, and we love Jim. He was glad that we were able to bring up this hot topic issue. He said, though, I didn't get my question answered, and that's right. So Jim wanted to know, could this end up in the courts, ultimately get into the Supreme Court? I assume this could be a lawsuit.
That's where it's going to go. Yep.
You think this particular case could be, unless the NLRB shoots it down, but then these kids, I guess, could
appeal.
Excuse me, not kids, adults could appeal.
Yeah, I think that's where it's going, right? This is just a regional director's decision. We have a long way to go. And yes, it could end up in the Supreme Court.
Could be years.
Yeah, it's just one finding in one region of the country. So yes, absolutely, it could go through the courts, and I'm sure it will.
And remember, John, the Northwestern regional director decision, found the same thing, and it just went nowhere. Yeah. So.
Jim, by the way, is going to the Hawks game tomorrow. Hope to see you there, Jim. His first game in 30 years. It's going to be a blast. It's the best day ever game. And those are always fun at the United Center. Rebecca wants to weigh in on this. Put on your headphones, Mike Leonard. And Rebecca, I have told them they cannot interrupt you during your thoughts on this. Go ahead.
Okay, great. I wrote down my thoughts so I would be succinct.
I love that.
So we have this power inequity between these institutions and these students. And the students come to the universities or they come to the colleges and they do not have the ability to get another job because they're doing academics and sport. They don't have the disposable income that other students can bring because of their dedication to their sport. So even in their off time, they're still dedicating themselves to the development of their sport. It's very difficult for them to work another job. rely on the school completely. They are, in essence, they are an employee of the university because they rely on them for all of their living expenses, their housing, their food, their sports equipment, everything they rely on. They give up everything to come to these universities for the chance. And I would even say that they're being exploited. And then finally, the creation of the NCAA is not in line. Surely their policies are not in line with the modern day reality that college sport is professional sport. It is no longer just a college sport like it was when the NCAA was created. And I'm wondering how soon this could go before the Supreme Court.
Rebecca, are you
Those
a lawyer?
Those are my thoughts. Thanks very much.
Rebecca, are you a lawyer?
No. No, I feel passionately about this because I work with college students. And I think I've seen firsthand how kids, you know, are dependent on the universities that bring them and make a lot of money off of them. And I think there's a power, there's an inequity there.
Yeah, I agree.
That power structure.
Well said, Rebecca.
Yeah, that was great.
So, Mike, I know you're okay with maybe paying them, and that would maybe answer her concerns about disposable income, not being able to work another job. But what about that thought that they really hold so much control over you that they essentially are an employer?
Well, I still disagree. I think Rebecca, first of all, had the best points of the day. She should have been on the show instead of us, especially Patrick.
Thanks. Yeah.
But in any event, I just disagree fundamentally with the idea of employee and each coach has to bargain with their team. I just find that unseemly. However, I 100% agree with Rebecca. There's a simple solution. NCAA says that universities can pay these people directly compensation. That would eliminate this whole issue, including bargaining with coaches over practice time and finding that they have to unionize or have to be employees. There's a simple, easy solution, which is already consistent with what the NCAA has already found, that they can make all sorts of money through NIL deals. Why can't the schools just pay them directly as well?
All right, well, I was going to retort, but Rebecca, I guess I'll give you a chance to have a response.
Well, I think that the bottom line is that what we're saying is that there has to be a change to the NCAA policy.
Yeah.
But universities need to be advocating for that. And even the private colleges need to advocate for that.
Thanks for the call, Rebecca.
So somebody needs to keep the student in mind.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No, I love that. That was well put. Mike, you seem like obsessed with this idea of like bargaining with the coaches. Couldn't the administration say, no, you bargain with us?
Yeah, that's not going to happen.
You bargain with the administration, they cover up, or the athletic director or something. It wouldn't be an individual. Maybe these teams could not unionize individually as teams. Maybe the athletes could at the school as a group unionize, and they could fight for general ideas of what it means to be an athlete employee at the school with the administration, not with an individual coach.
Well, sure, that maybe happened. The Dartmouth case is one team, right? But I think it's unrealistic to think the coach is not going to be the subject of the bargaining. And what would stop the team from, whether they have to negotiate directly with the university officials or the coach, from saying, we want to remove this guy. He's too hard. His practices are too long. He's too tough on us.
Well, he's an employee.
We're not going to play. We're not going to play on this team, the group of us, unless he's removed.
Right,
why not?
1 minute.
Yeah, but that's not how it works. I mean, the negotiation is between the student athlete and the university. And, the coaching, who is the coach, the practices, et cetera, maybe those aren't even things that are bargained for. Okay, you have to agree with what's on the table, and maybe the university's like, we're not going to discuss with you who the coach is or what their practice hours are. That's part of the negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
You're assuming all this straight takes place, and it just doesn't.
Are there no coaches listening who could call in right now and solve this?
We're out of time.
Coaches, please call.
224 said you guys are crazy. I think probably me and Patrick are crazy. It's no different than joining the military. You're making a choice. I would say military is
paid.
Number one, which Mike isn't arguing that you shouldn't be, but you also do have mechanisms to lodge. There's an apparatus. It's not like the workforce. You are told places you have to go, and you don't have as much control over your job and where you go. But the military, there is probably... Is there an HR? I mean, like, there's ways to file claims.
Yeah.
There's ways to be protected from discrimination, right? Like, there are things in the military. There's mechanisms in the military that allow you to do it. So I don't think that's a fair comparison. Patrick, we got to go. I'm sorry. You have a lot of great points.
That's okay.
Where can people reach you at for employment law questions?
312-332-7800. Thanks, John.
And Mr. Mike Leonard, where can people reach you?
312-380-6559.
Say that one more time, because people should put it in their phone in case the feds come knocking on the door.
Or the state authorities,
or the state authorities,
yeah. 312-380-6559.
All right, we're going to take a break, and we have news from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.